the last time we have been dealing with the Shweta Ketu story for Richard and others who didn't sort of follow this, and trying to look at it from a literary point of view rather than from purely a theological or philosophical or historical point of view. And sort of we have gone through the way the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Chandogya Upanishad represent narratively the character of Shweta Ketu and his relationship to his father, to the king, etc. And then the major doctrinal part comes right at the end, and we have this Panchagni Vidya, the doctrine of the five fires, and this is sort of a put into sacrificial terminology, the way a human being transmigrates from earth to the heavens and back to earth in a very almost materialistic and physical way, as going up in smoke and turning to rain, and rain coming down and becoming food, and food being eaten, and food eaten being converted into semen. And these all very much a male-oriented presentation of the rebirth story. Women accept they are merely as the recipient of the seed, and then the whole thing is repeated.
Given that it's so male,
yes,
everywhere.
Yes.
Have you any idea what they thought happened to women when they died?
They don't say anything here.
No, I know.
Except
that
the
no,
no. Except the assumption would be that women also go through this, but they have to go through the same end process in order to come back into earth.
You think
the
that is the assumption? Or they're not like the creepy crawlies.
But the creepy crawlies, that's very interesting there also, because that's the last two things that we did last time, is that's only in the Chandogya, which seems to say that's the third way,
yeah,
where there is no escape, sort of they go on being born and dying, you know, kind of thing. And that's an interesting little side doctrine. But the other one seems to be good, but it's also connected to some kind of way to heaven. I think Thieme has written on this, way to heaven, and this is in a more descriptive narrative way presented in the Kaushitika Upanishad, in the parallel passage, where you have the actual description of going to a lake and having to swim across the lake, and various, you know, it's like a almost a journey, a sort of a epic journey, you know, through various obstacles.
But is there a shred of evidence that a woman did it?
No, there's always in the male category. Mm. Yeah, except the only thing is I can see with regard to the I've written on this little article on the Brihadaranyaka side, there you have Maitreyi, who comes and talks to Yajnavalkya, and he says, Amritasyam, give me the knowledge by which I can become Amrita. The first time you have the word Amrita in the feminine here, you know, it's almost always either in the masculine or in the neuter, which is a sort of substantive thing. And then you have in the Brihadaranyaka also Gargi coming in later, debating Yajnavalkya on equal footing. So there seems to be at least one tradition in which women play some role and some significant role. But this is where I think we may need to, in discussing ancient India, not paint the whole thing with a single brush. Mm-hmm. There may be traditions that are very different. And in some traditions, women may be playing a stronger role than in others, especially in the Brihadaranyaka. Joel Brereton, my colleague, has written on this. One of the themes that is running through many of the Upanishads, including the Chandogya, but Brihadaranyaka especially, is that knowledge comes from strange and unexpected sources. And that's an interesting thing. So you have birds doing this, and bulls doing it, and various non-human beings doing it. Raikva doing it, who are sort of scratching his itch under a cart. This is sort of strange guys, including kings now, you know, in this particular one. Who should not be teaching, but who are teaching. So very unexpected ways, and women also then come into that, I think. Women, you don't expect great things from women, but here you do. Gargi is possibly the, as I said, Gargi in this discussion with Yajnavalkya and this all this group of main Kurupanchala Brahmins, you know, this Western-Eastern conflict, theological conflict. Yajnavalkya is an Easterner from Videha. All the others are Kurupanchalas who were sort of the mainstay. So it's like, I don't know, Oxford professors versus Sussex or whatever, you know, sort of the up-and-coming guys versus the establishment. I think that is that. And Gargi is part of this establishment from Kurupanchala.
But to point about what happens to the women themselves when they die.
That I mean, is...
In the ritual, yes. You don't do anything for dead women, do you? It's all for the dead males to be with their pitaras.
We don't find any rituals in this, but when you come to the Griha Sutras, you do find rituals for women. And the women are part of the Shraddha thing, Pitara, Mataraha, and Pitaraha, but clearly a subordinate role. And the main Shraddha, the Parvana Shraddha, is offered to the three Pitaras, you know, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. Mm. And so that is there. But gradually you find the women coming in to the ritual role. How far back that goes, we really do not know. And so that's the real problem. Mm-hmm. But anyway, continuing with the character of Shvetaketa, please.
In the Upanishads, is there an idea mentioned of women following their husbands, or is that a very late idea?
That's a very late idea. In terms of Anugamana, as a sati kind of Anugamana, dying, the earliest textual evidence that you get, apart from epic evidence, which is sort of a heroic death kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you eliminate that, like Sita and all that, you get is in the Vishnu Smriti, which is the Vishnu Dharma Shastra, which is probably a Kashmiri text around the 7th century. I just made a critical edition of it 2.5 years ago, and Motilal is sitting on it and not brought it out. And it's very clear that it's Kashmiri, and it's very clear that it is post 6th century, probably 7th or 8th. And that's the earliest reference we have with regard to the Anugamana. It could have been even a regional thing, like a northwestern Indian phenomenon. But then by the 9th century with Medhatiti, you find a very clear acceptance of this practice into the Brahmanical theory. Although Medhatiti, commenting on Manu has nothing on this, but commenting on one passage of Manu, actually rejects the thing. So he was against it. And one of my students, David Brick, has just wrote an article. I gave it to you, right? Sent it to you, which shows the history of the Dharma Shastric involvement with Sati all the way to the 17th century, which is very interesting. The other thing that I wanted to do today, maybe, is look at chapter 6, which is, I think you have that. Mm-hmm. I have given. If you're not, we have here a text. And this is where, and this is Chandogya. Brihadaranyaka Shvetaketu exits and he's not there anymore. In the sixth chapter, which is a chapter immediately following the Shvetaketu story we studied, you find Shvetaketu again introduced. And he says at the beginning, Shvetaketu Haruneha Asa. There was a Shvetaketu, the son of Aruni. Tangha Pita Uvacha, to him for the father, says, Shvetaketu was a Brahmacharya. Shvetaketu lived the Brahmacharya, life of a student. Navai Samya Asmat Kulino Ananuchya Brahmabandur Iva Bhavatiti. So there is no one in our family, my dear one, who without studying Ananuchya, Brahmabandur Iva, you know, like a just a Brahmin by name kind of thing, has been. Okay. So he went, so Dvadacha Varsham Upetya, so having gone to a teacher for 12 years, when he was 12 years, Chaturvinshti Varshaha, at 24, Sarvan Vedan Adhitya, having studied all the Vedas, Anuchanamani, thinking himself well educated, Stabdha, being proud, you know, got his degree, Aaya, he came back. So again, we saw the Chandogya preference to the E forms of going, right? Whereas the Brihadaranyaka uses the word gam, you know, say Aaya. So, Tangha Pita Uvacha. To him, the father said, Shvetaketu, O Shvetaketu, Yannu saumya idam mahamana anuchanamani stabdovasi. So this is very interesting. We are reconfirming this guy is a brat. You know, he thinks he's really. We had that already here, but this is a second storyline. You know, which sort of seems to connect. Shvetaketu, here you are, my friend, swell-headed, thinking yourself to be learned and arrogant. Then he asks, Uta tam adesham aprokshyo yena ashrutam shrutam bhavati amatam matam avignatam vignatam iti. So, did you find out, aprakshyo, did you ask about the adesha, the thing we talked about last time also, right? Adesha, and quite frequently translated as the teaching. But actually, adesha probably here has a technical meaning, which comes from the grammar, which is a rule of substitution. And how you can substitute one for the other. So when you know that, you know, when you know X, you can know Y. Okay? So you must have asked for that rule of substitution by which one hears what has not been heard of before, thinks of what has not been thought of before, and perceives what has not been perceived before. Then he has katam nubhagava sa adesho bhavati. So how is this rule of substitution? How does that work? Then he goes on to this very, very famous one. It's from a lump of clay. You can get everything out of clay. So in a sense, everything else that we find in the world, it's a bit of almost like a Sankhyan thing, you know, from a more primitive source, something more manifest and multiple comes out of this. And this very interesting vacharambanam vikaro namadheyam mrittika iti eva satyam. The reality is only mrittika. Okay, everything else is a vacha arambana. I've written a note on this arambana. You know, so it's almost like a step on a ladder, sort of where you can get a foothold. You know? So it's a verbal handle. That's how I've tried to translate it. A mere name. This transformation, the vikara. So vikara has been another interesting term. You know, which is later is in philosophy. You know. And it goes on like that with various other nail cutter and all that. And this is how this substitution works. And the son now is quite contrite and he is humbled. And he says that those my teachers probably didn't know this, you know. That's why they did not tell me. And he says, tell me more. And then we have this thing going Aruni, Uddalaka, teaches his son up to 7. And in this part, at the very beginning, we have this very interesting, Saddeva saumya idam agra asid ekam eva advitiyam. At the beginning, there was Sat, one alone, without a second. On this some say, asad eva. Idam agra asit advitiyam. So this is an ancient thing you find already in the Rig Veda, I think, the whole dispute between the beginning where there was asat or sat. As far as I know, at the Rig Vedic time, asat had a very specific meaning and not a meaning of a disorderly as opposed to an orderly sat asat. Chaos versus, you know, reality as we know it. But by this time, I think it has taken on a different meaning, the sad as a more philosophical meaning, as a being. And that something can come from asat seems to be rather, you know, strange. And this is what he is trying to get at. It's impossible to get. With that, he stops there. But what is interesting here, I think, from a philosophical or theoretical point of view, is what you find in 2-3, where this one thought to itself that it wants to propagate. This is the same thing that you find in many Upanishadic passages. There was one at the beginning, and it was lonely, or it really didn't like to be alone, and then it wants to be bahusyan, so let me be many. And from that, you get the creation coming up. This theme is there in the Brahmana literature also, right? And this is where you find here So this and in 3 here then and 12, let me become many, let me propagate myself, bahusyam, and then here you find it emitted heat. And he thought to itself, let me be many, let me propagate myself, it emitted water. So you have the sat emitting heat, heat emitting water, and water, then let me be many, and it produces food. So you have this threefold sat, and after sat, which is there at the very top, you find heat, water, and food. And this is the theme that is, the threefoldness is something that is taken through up to seven, when this storyline ends, and it goes on in three to look at the three sources. You know, this is the earliest statement about the three kinds of living beings. The classification later on it becomes five. This is the andaja, you know, jivaja and udbija. Yeah. So this is the threefold thing, and four. If you go to the next one, you find the same the heat, water. So you find red appearance fire is heat, the white. There are water. Is black, and there are and black is there are food. So you find the red, the white, and the black. So very interesting. This again, you find the Sankhya categories later on adapting the similar color differentiation of these cosmic forces, and he goes on with the fire, the sun, the moon, the lightning. And then in the fifth, this is interesting, in 4-5, it goes, it was indeed this that they knew, those extremely wealthy and immensely learned householders, you know, Mahashala, Mahashrotriya. What did they know? This they knew, and when they knew this, no one will be able to spring something upon us that we have not heard of or thought of or understood before.
Isn't it very odd that there are three reds? Four. And that the moon, for instance, is said to be red.
Yes.
Isn't that very strange?
Yes. The only thing I can think of is that the moon, as well as the sun, is viewed as forms of fire. Within this system, and fire has the red, the white, and you know, the fire is red.
Yeah, sure. And the moon is a form of fire that goes against all the other categories, doesn't it? I mean, it's always connected with water, white, etc., etc.
Absolutely. Yes. And here it is taken as a form of fire.
It's taken as all three, isn't it?
All of them. The lightning is also as a form of fire. Yeah. So you have these three, the fire here, and three kinds of fire above. One in the atmosphere, which is lightning, and two as parts of the heavenly thing. The sort of the thing that they would have. And in a sense, it just goes down in the fifth, sixth, and seventh, how the food, when it is eaten, becomes threefold. It's sort of this whole thing on three, playing on the term three that is going on in this whole thing. It is unclear, and we will see as I go into the next one, whether all these were actually together as a unit at the beginning, or whether they were brought together at a later time. It's clearly when you go into the eight through the next thing through 13. It is very clear that many have been sort of added. This central story gathered others to itself, you know, more and more. And because it's a For example, when you go to 8, for example, Udalak says to his son, learn from me the nature of sleep. Quite a different thing, being brought into this, mostly because it also has this threefold thing coming in the explanation. So this, it's almost like the Buddhist, the Anguttaras and all that, where just numbers are gathering various things together into a sequence. But the threefold thing goes on, and then 5, 6 and 7, they all try to show how food taken into the human being breaks up into various constituents, the fine, the middling, and the gross, and that is how the human being is constituted. I think that's what we have here. So when one eats food, it breaks into three parts, the three again, the densest become feces, the medium becomes flesh, and the finest become mind. So mind, flesh, and feces. When one drinks water, the densest becomes urine, blood, and breath. When one eats heat, I don't know what exactly this is, there's somehow the taking in warmth into you, breaks down into three parts, the densest become bones here, so it's a heat bone, medium becomes marrow, and the finest becomes speech. For the mind is made up of food, sun, breath of water, and speech of heat. So the whole of the human being then is now again made up of three things, food, water, and heat. Seven, there is a little bit more discourse. Until now, it was just a matter of teaching. There's a little bit of dialogue here. And here he says, a man, my son, consists of 16 parts. Do not eat for 15 days, but drink water at will. This is sort of the Chandrayana kind of thing, not eating for till the moon, the halfway through the moon. A breath is made of water, so it will not be cut off if one drinks. So ask him to drink water, but don't eat. Shvetaketu did not eat for 15 days. Then he came back to his father and said, so this is a narrative going on. There's a third voice, narrator's voice coming too. There's quite a bit of first person, and there's a third person here. What shall I recite, sir? He said, the Rig verses, the Rig, the Yajush, and the Saman. And he said, I can't remember them. The father said to him, it's like this, son. Out of a huge fire that has been built, if there is left only a single ember the size of a firefly, by means of that fire thereafter would not burn that much. Likewise, son, you are left with only one of your 16 parts. By means of that, at present, you don't remember the Vedas. Eat, and then you will learn from me. He ate and then came back to his father, and he answered everything that his father asked. And the father said to him, it's like this, son, out of a huge fire, and it goes on like that. If it were to cover it with straw and set it ablaze, by that you can burn a lot. So once you are eaten, so the food becomes the mind here. That's sort of the... I don't know why that 16 comes in, because the moon has 16 digits or 15? I think 15. And
the aggregate.
Okay, so it just 16.
Went all the way.
16. Mm. So you find the month thing coming in here, yes. Right? Yeah, 16. Yeah. Okay, so he did love. This seems to be end of one story, at least one storyline which had been brought together. then you find. From 8 onwards, a second narrative, which may have existed separately, being brought into the 6th chapter of the Chandogya, and it starts again with the introductory, which would not have been needed if this was just a continuation of the previous. And of course, the 3 is over now, the 3, and now we find something quite different, perhaps the most significant for later Vedanta thought, of Upanishads, you know, where you have the Tattvam Asi. This is the place where it comes, right? And so 8 to 13 is a new storyline. Uddaloko harunihi shvetaketum putram uvacha svapnantam me samya vijani hiti. So he tells his son, learn from me the nature of sleep. He goes on, I want to go through this 8, when the man is thirsty, this is sort of the play on homonymy or similar sounding words, you know, etc. But where it ends, when a man is right at the top there, when a man is dying, his speech merges into his mind into his breath into heat, and heat into the highest deity, Paramaya Parasyam Devatayam. Then 7, you begin this thing. Ya esho anima, so this thing that is very, this fine thing, etad atmyam idam sarvam, this whole world, idam here is a diatic, again a pronoun, idam sarvam, everything here, as opposed to asau, which is the heaven, idam sarvam, this whole world, etad atmyam, having this for its essence or self, right? Tat satyam, that is the truth or the real, tat satyam, and that works well, tat as a satyam, satyam is neuter and tat is neuter. Sa atma, this is a self. See how the pronoun changes to sa, right? Tattvam asi shveta keto, o shveta ketu, you are, then you have tat here. Interpreted generally to mean that, which is impossible in Vedic grammar. It should have been sattvam asi, shveta keto. So as Joel in his thing has shown, tat here would have to be taken as adverbial. And it makes sense. This is the way you are. This is what constitutes you. So tena tvamasi would be something that in this manner you exist. How? Etadatmyam. Having this as your essence. The problem is, in this context of the 8, this becomes very difficult to understand. Because 7, Sarja Esha, Esho Anima Etadatmyam, that 7th section has been put here quite artificially, I think, and Joel has written an article on that. If you go, though, to 12, which probably was its original home, you can see something much, much easier to understand. And here you have a dialogue, just like we had earlier. So father and son are talking to each other. And you must realize that 12 is right in the middle. There are four sections before and 4 sections after. Altogether, there are 9 sections. And right in the center is the heart of this discourse. All these 9 ends with the same refrain, Tattvamasi refrain, right? But it is here that in its original home we can probably find its original sense. So let's sort of try to read that a little. Nyagrodha phalam ata ahara iti. Bring a banyan fruit. Idam bhagavaiti. Here it is, sir. Bindiiti. Cut it up. Binnam bhagavaiti. I've cut it up, sir. Kimatra pashyasi. What do you see there? Anvya iva ima dhana bhagavaiti. These quite tiny, anvaya iva, as if anu, you know, as if very, very, very small, you know, as if atomic. These seeds, he sees them. Asam anga ekam binditi. Of these, cut up one in those three little ones. Binna Bhagavati. Now they have been cut, or I have cut them. Kimatra Pashyasi. What do you see there? Nakinchana Bhagavati. I don't see anything. It's too small to see. Tangho Vacha. So he told him, Yangvai Saumya Etam Animanam Nandibhalayasa. This finest essence, this finest thing, your son, that you can't even see, Nandibhalayasa, or you can't fathom. Esho Animna Evang Mahang Nyagrodas Tishtati. Look how, on account of that finest essence, Animna, this huge banyan tree stands here. So this something that this animal, this you can't even see, that's what has given right to this huge tree. Right? Then you this is sort of the introduction here. Shraddhatsva Saumyeti, put faith or have faith here. Believe my son, I put it. It's interesting, this sort of goes somewhat against what I said last time about Shraddha, right? As you can see here. So it's the semantic compass of Shraddha, or especially here, of course, in the verbal form, not Shraddha as such, is quite broad. Put faith here. Then you find the same thing repeated. So, ya esho anima etad atmyam idam sarvam. Now that is very clear, it's already made the introduction. This whole world has the same animan, like this Nyagrodha, something you cannot see. So the relationship is much better here than in the very first one, where this came without any introduction and connection to what preceded is quite unclear. Tat Satyam, that is the reality, that is the truth. Sa Atma, this is the self. Tattvam Asi Svet Keto. In other words, he is trying to say that you are by means of this animan. That's the meaning of tat here. So you are not the animan. Just like the Nyagrodha is there because of this animan. You are there because of that tat. So that's Joe's argumentation here for the interpretation of tat, which fits in to this particular context quite well. Then it goes on, Bhujeva, and teach me more, and all that. That's a refrain that goes on here.
Have you anything thoughts about the fact, perhaps I'm not right, but Nibhalaya, sir, seems it's a rare word.
It's a rare word, yes.
It's extraordinary to use such a sort of long and pompous word, and you could have said precious.
Yes, anyway, yes.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
Huh?
You have any thoughts about why he used such a rare word?
No, I need to actually think about it. especially looking at where else it occurs. And that's not a difficult thing to do, now that we have all the indexes and all that to help us.
In Raghuvamsa, you have that. Rama is coming flying.
But here it's in the negative, you see.
Nanibhalayasa.
But never mind. This root has a little bit more thorough.
Mm-hmm. If you go through that, then the meaning will be something like, you can't see it even if you try very hard.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's like today we would say you can't even see it through a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
If you are taking your view, that may be something that you are saying. You just don't see it because you don't, just seeing, but you are looking very hard and you can't still see it because it's cut up. That's very interesting, yes. So you have here then, I think, the the center of this around which this has been constructed. As you can see, the one just before that, 11, talks about Mahato Vrikshasya, a big tree. So in a sense, it is leading onto the Nyagrodha. And and it deals with a jiva, an atman, and all of that. And it says that when this jiva leaves one branch, it withers, and if it leaves the whole tree, it withers. And then in three, evam eva kalu saumya vidhityo vacha. Saying like the same way he continued, no jiva petam vavakela idam riyate. Know that this dies when it is bereft of jiva, whatever that may mean. So he's using the word jiva here. Na jivo mriyate, but the jiva doesn't die. It's a lot more technical words than in 12 here. Then he goes the finest essence here. An animan has not been introduced, and it all of a sudden in the final it comes up. So you can see that this last bit has been sort of tagged on to all these without it flowing naturally from the context as it does in 12. In 10, we saw this where the reverse sun, easterly ones flow to the east, westerly ones flow to the west. There's an interesting geographical little note here because these people knew that there were two kinds of rivers in northern India, the eastern flowing rivers and the western flowing rivers, which is an interesting little tidbit here. They were aware of the northern Indian geography. Flows to the east and the western flows to the west. From the ocean, they merge into the very ocean. They become just this ocean. In that state, they are not aware that I am that river, I am this river. So it's this large existence in which individuality is subsumed. In exactly the same way, sun, when all these creatures reach the existent, sat, again, we have seen that. They are not aware we are reaching the existent. No matter what they are in this world, whether it's a tiger, lion, wolf, boar, worm, moth, gnat, mosquito, they all merge into that. Tad abhavanti. This is an interesting, strong use of the word abhavati. Then they tag on this same thing again, you know, the tattvamasi thing, yesha anima, which has nothing to do with what went before. We're not talking about an animan anymore. And 9, likewise, you have take the bees. The bees gather nectar from various trees, reduce them into one homogeneous whole. In that state, the nectar from different trees are not able to distinguish, I'm nectar from this tree, I'm nectar from that tree. So it's all this from many merging into one. You know, that's a theme that you find in this sixth chapter, but has very little to do with this animan thing that we were talking about, you know, which takes off from 12.
It's a very tenuous thread, I know, but you're very good at exploiting some of the such threads. If you look at the beginnings of 11 and 12, the very first words.
Yes.
11 says, from this big tree here, Asya, he's pointing to it, they're sitting under it.
Right.
12, he says, Nyagrodha palam atta ahara.
Yeah.
Bring a Nyagrodha feet from it.
Yes.
So it's the same tree, probably.
That is interesting, the word atta here, and whether it really has the later meaning of atta in the sense of from there, or it has the same meaning as itaha, you know, which would be here. I've been taking the atta here has having the same meaning as itaha, meaning bring it here, rather than from there, but it's a possibility.
With ahara, bring.
Ahara, bring. Yeah.
It's more natural, isn't it? It's an ablative.
Yes, it is an ablative. It's certainly possible. My initial reaction against it, that would be, I don't think these two are ever connected in a narrative, as a narrative whole. You know, these were probably very, very different, because this this clearly is the source of this tattvamasi thing, which is being repeated over and over again. But this is where, I mean, I have not done a very as close a reading of this as one should. Joel has done this, but those are the kinds of paying attention to little details that we have been talking about a little in class here.
But as a point of general method here, I mean, often if you compare two important little chunks of text in Buddhism, in the Tipitaka, which are close to being the same, and you find the differences, it is often the most plausible explanation, not that you had one and then it influenced the other, but rather that
They were put together.
They grew up together, and they influenced each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it's afterwards. This is going on down the generations, repeating them.
Right. Now, I mean, and then of course, I mean, these little things like this. Once the what could be called an anthology was brought together, they can each can introduce influence each other.
That's
it's
point,
very
yes.
clear. Right. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. But then, from 13, it becomes interesting here, which are rather different and gives us interest. The 13 is the salt metaphor. Walter Szilágyi, and probably some of you know him, who's Paul Wittenberg, has written several detailed articles on salt metaphor in the Upanishads. Very detailed and almost too detailed, it's clear that this also what he's saying is that around the Indus Valley, after the rains have gone, salt naturally appears on the surface of the lake. So in a sense, that's this natural coming of the surface. And that becomes the imagination that's a sort of the from where many of these metaphors are taken. But here this is interesting, that the earliest person who worked on it was Thema. So here he says, there's this lavanam, etat udake avadhaya ma pratar udasita. So put this chunk of salt in water and come back tomorrow. I put as a container of water, I think it was a container, not a lake or something like that, right? Because he could throw the water away later on, you know, so it was some kind of a jug. The son did as he was told. The father sent to him in the morning now, that salt you put in last evening, bring it here. So he went and put his hand around to find the piece of salt, couldn't find it. It had dissolved completely, right? Yata vilinam eva, so it's completely... Then he tells him, take a sip from this corner, take a sip from that corner, and he found that it was all salty. I use the word salty here because you can't do otherwise. But in Sanskrit, it is lavanamiti. This is lavana, that is lavana, here is lavana. You put the lavana and you taste the lavana. You can grasp it with your hand, you can't see it with your eyes, but you can taste it. Yeah, so it's the same word is used, and I thought in English it's difficult to say how does it taste. Can't say salt. I guess you can, but
you could say it tastes of salt.
Or it tastes of salt, but then it's still that power of the lavanam, you know. And then he says, you know, it was all the time there, you know, even though you couldn't see it. So that's where we go. Then he says at the end, lavanam, abhiprasya etat atha ma upasidatha. So throw it out and come back to me later. He did as he was told, and this is the thing that people couldn't have not been able to really understand. Akara tatshashat sangvartete. As he was told, and found that it was always there. That was always there. The father told him, you of course did not see it there, son, yet it was always right there. So how, in all likelihood, and this is what Pima has been saying, is that he probably threw it out in some place where it could evaporate. Mm. And so once it had evaporated, you find that the salt has crystallized. The water is gone.
Mm-hmm.
He saw. He said, oh, it was always there. So that's the sort of the at least Pima's mm-hmm. interpretation of this. Why he, all of a sudden, even though he had tasted and found the salt, when he threw away, he said, oh my God, it was always there, right? That sort of a awareness coming. And that may be because he has thrown it and it's evaporated. Then you find the same refrain, the finest essence here, which sits a little uncomfortably with what went before, because we have not talked about anything animan here anymore. We have just talked about the presence of the salt in a dissolved form. There may be other philosophical things to be taken from that, but this particular thing sits rather uncomfortably. And then you have in 14 another thing, which gives an interesting example of their geographical knowledge, because they knew something called the Gandhara, so which is far northwest of India. This is something that is composed probably in the central regions of India, probably in the Kuru-Panchala region, which is sort of the Benares area. So he says, a man who has been brought blindfolded from the land of Gandhara and left in a deserted region. As he was brought blindfolded and left there blindfolded, he would drift about towards the east or the north or the south. The problem here is that he doesn't say west, because if he had gone west, he would have gone there. So it's just the three. But anyway, that's unclear why the only three are mentioned. Now, if someone were to free him from his blindfold and tell him, go that way, the Gandhara is in that direction, being a learned and wise man, he would go from village to village, asking for directions, and finally arrive in the land of Gandhara. In exactly the same way in this world, when a man has a teacher, we talked about the importance of the teacher here now, he knows there is a delay for me here only until I am freed, but then I will arrive, sampatsit. Then that finest essence comes in, quite detached from the story. Mm-hmm. 15, you have a similar thing when a person is gravely ill. This occurs elsewhere in the Upanishads also. This, how do you know you are dying or dead? His relatives gather around him and ask, Do you recognize me? As long as his voice does not merge into his mind into his breath, this gradual collapsing, vilaya, from one to the other, into heat. So we had that, breath and mind, we had that already in the earlier part of this story. And into the highest deity, he recognizes them. When, however, his voice merges into his mind, etc., etc., he no longer recognizes him. In other places, this whole thing is explained more, in a more detailed fashion, but here is very, very brief, and then we have the finest essence being put on there. Then 16, it's again very, very interesting. These are the earliest examples of an audial in Indian literature that we have. Audial meaning a test, a divine test, for somebody who is accused of a crime. I take, for example, a man, manacled man brought here by people shouting, he's a thief, he has committed a theft, heat an axe for him. So this is the fire ordeal, which is different in the Dharma Shastras, whether it is a round ball, and you have to carry it in your hand through various circles and then drop it at the end, and your hand is not burned, then you're innocent. But here it is somewhat different. In the Dharma Sutras, they put a green particular pipala, I think, leaf on your hand, so it's not directly touching your hand. So you first rub rice powder, just that reveals all the any other blemishes that is there, then put the thing, and then put the red hot thing, and then you go and drop it, and then they look at your hand. But this is an axe, and that's all there is here. Now, if he is guilty of the crime, he turns himself into a lie. Uttering a lie and covering himself in lie, he takes hold of the axe and gets burnt, upon which he is executed. This is very interesting. Theft means execution here. And that's very true also of the Dharmashastri prescriptions, especially theft of gold. Not any theft, but theft was considered a very serious crime. If, on the other hand, he is innocent of the crime, then he turns himself into truth. Uttering the truth and covering himself with the truth, he takes hold of the axe and is not burnt, upon which he is released. This is again this satya, you know, you find in the Buddhist text too, you know, the how truth can protect you. And this is what it is. Now,
you say this is the earliest, I mean, it's the earliest in a strictly judicial setting. But I seem to remember that there's Vedic material, Norman Brown wrote about the act of truth, satra kriya.
Yes. But I'm talking about the ordeal.
As an ordeal, it's really the same phenomenon.
Exactly. That there are cosmic forces that will protect you if you tell the truth.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the ordeal is built on that. But the ordeal, we are getting away from this. Ordeal is not isn't a term for ordeal or up to manu.
Mm-hmm.
For manu also, it is the word that he uses is shapata. Mm. Hmm? And shapata is actually an oath, which can be had in other contexts. So it was not a very central part of the judicial process. When you come to Yajnavalkya, couple of centuries later, the standard term of later Dharmashastra, which is Divya, is invented. Present. And then from there on, it becomes a common part of the 6 or 8 or 12 kinds of Divya, poison, and the various kinds of things that you have, water, balance. It's lots of, you get onto it and you're weighed, and then
yes.
You do various things, and you're weighed a second time, and there's a whole controversy whether you should weigh more or less. Some say you should weigh more, depending on how you interpret this whole thing. But this is the earliest we have of the fire ordeal. As a real judicial audio, right? Then here, and the 16, very interesting because the last refrain is changed. Okay? And there's a connection. Sa yatha tatra na adhayeta. So that by which he did not get burnt. This something, this truth, you know, whatever. Etad atmiyam idam sarvam. So it's not no longer the animan now. It's been changed into something different. And then tat satyam, etc. That goes on there. So that's, and with that, sort of, it ends. And Adhyaya 7 goes on with another, Narada with Sanat Kumara, again, a pupil. That's about it, I have to say. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question on this, on the theft from a seat.
Uh-huh.
I heard this also in my Sanskrit class, and what surprises me is that Shankara based so much of his philosophy on this, and then those who responded to him, like Ramanuja and Madhva, even though they were, you know, strong dualists and they were arguing against him, they also, at least I haven't read where they pointed out this grammatical mistake. They would agree that yes, this is an identity text, but then we disagree with this philosophy because you have to look at the other texts.
Right.
So the question that came up to me is, why is it that they sort of overlooked this when they were quite, it seems as if they're very well versed in Upanishadic Sanskrit and all
right.
These things.
Right. I have no idea. I have no idea. The only thing I can tell is that Shankara clearly was not the first person to interpret it in this way. So it must have been a long tradition of interpretation. And once the tradition gets going, I think it is easy to not take a very literal view of a thing like this. We are trying to look at it from a purely linguistic, historical point of view. Mm-hmm. These people are not doing that. These people are doing theology. Mm-hmm. And theologically, it is very legitimate to see this thought. Forget about the grammar. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? When why follow grammar all the time? Because sometimes people can say ungrammatical things, mm-hmm. right?
It's a very Brahminical thing to say.
Absolutely. The tradition of Advaita Vedanta hermeneutics had developed very sophisticated ways of getting meaning, what they wanted, out of texts, surely the Bhagavad Gita is not an Advaita text. You know, but Shankara, you know, carries it into the Advaita fold, right? So it's not very difficult, I think, for a person to find theologically relevant material in the Tattva Maji. But also it's so beautiful. I mean, the three words, each monosyllabic, you know, it's so easy to get it as an iconic almost thing, right? You know, it's a verbal icon. Because there are other Mahavakyas too, you know. I mean, there are 16 Mahavakyas in the Advaita things, right? And they talk about all the Aham Brahmasmi and all that. But nothing took on a life as iconic and as central as a Tattvamasi, business. Unfortunately, that is, from a linguistic point of view, the weakest. Aham Brahmasmi is quite okay, you know. or any of the other things are quite fine, I think. And unfortunately, this is the weakest from a grammatical point of view. But it became, of course, the central. But I mean, even you know, using Joel's interpretation, one can still bring it into that Advaita fold. You exist because I mean, right now through this power that is in you, which is Brahman, right? I mean, it is not one of equation and identity, but something more extended than that. So it's not impossible to do that. But that's what the story is getting at too. There's something very very subtle in the world, right? And this subtle thing that you cannot see and you cannot hold is what keeps the whole world going. You know, in its manifest, you know, multiplicity. And that's what Advaita ultimately, in a more philosophical way, says too, right? This multiplicity underlying that, there is something that is unique and subtle. So it's not completely out of the...
Because I guess if the essence is one, it says that's what you are like, then it could be interpreted as well. That's what you are.
Yes. Yes. No. Certainly. Right. That is what you are in it, in your very, very essence. Mm-hmm. That's. I think it's fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm worried about 14. It seems totally inept, doesn't it? I mean, there's no kind of link at all.
There's no link at all. As I said, these are just nice stories that have been sort of put together. So that's why this. I mean. It's strange that a lot of people not have seen the artificiality of this link before Joel wrote his article on this that 12 is the central and that's where we need to look at it to find its original setting and therefore possibly its original meaning from which it has been sort of expanded both ways and it's very interesting. There is a certain beauty to it. There's a central and then from which you have this. A lot of things leading up to 12 and a lot of things leading away from 12. But the 12 is the middle. That's very interesting. It's very similar to the Nashadiya the thing where Joel again has written a very, very admirable. I've seen that it's probably the most wonderful article on interpreting Vedic poetry that you'll see. And there too, there is this middle verse is the most significant. Mm-hmm. From which it comes. And what it says is that it's very interesting that at the end, the last verse, when it says that perhaps he doesn't know, nobody knows, is incomplete. Metrically incomplete. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's very interesting that this non-knowledge, this leaving everything hanging sort of thing, even the meter is hanging. which nobody has really mm-hmm. paid attention to.
Do you have a surname?
Brereton. Brereton. Nice British name, I think, right? Brereton. Joel. Brereton. Yeah, I'm not sure where it was published, but I think it was published in the Indo-Iranian Journal.
You
can Google it.
You
yeah.
can find it.
Yeah. JSTOR. JSTOR.
Actually, when the people, the redactor finally concluded this text, would he have had this, would he have had a lot of other material that was shaping it to this final form?
That's an interesting thing. I'm working right now with the Ashokan material, which is also interesting because Ashokan material are also anthologies. And I'm looking at them as anthologies. Anthology means that somebody not only selected something but also excluded others. Of course, we will never know what he excluded. But it's interesting that at least that's the question that we need to be... It's like formation of any canon. When you have a canon, there are always texts that are excluded, and we know in the Christian canon, we at least have some idea of what those may be, Gnostic Gospels and all that. But things that didn't fit in for whatever literary, theological, or other reasons, I think, that you have. So clearly, these were anthologies, and if he composed all this, then he must have been a bad writer. You know, I mean, for him not to make some connection, right? One can only think is that he had this, and he sort of, this was mechanically put in there. And that's the only thing one can think of as an excuse for him.
the middle comes as the link to what went further?
Yeah, at least as Joel has explained in the Nashadiya, middle seems to be a very significant thing. Sort of something leading up. It's, if you think of the middle as a crescendo, then you can see up and down rather than a middle in a linear thing. Yeah. So you're going up and then you're coming down, and this is at least the central focus.
The apex,
right, yes. Yeah, of the thing. And it's also interesting that chapter 16, or 12, chapter 6 has 16 sections. Okay, and we saw the 16 as a significant number earlier, you know, in terms of number 16. So there are sort of numeral little things too going on here. These 8, you know, altogether, and 9 plus.
But as you know, that's very problematic because it's hard to find a number which isn't significant.
Absolutely. Only thing this is significant is that within the 16, 16 becomes significant. No, not outside of it. But it has nothing to. Mm. Yep. But. And the other thing, of course, is it's very unclear when and how this collection was put together the way we have it now, you know. And that's the its textual history is quite lost, you know, before, let's say, the, 7th, 8th century. So we have almost a millennium or little less than a millennium of textual history over which we have no idea what's happening here, right? Because the manuscript tradition starts much later than that, and the earliest commentary is Shankara. So where was it, and who put this together? So when we say that these are evidence for 6th century or 5th century BC, take that with some a grain of salt, because some of these texts are quite old, certainly, you know, but the way we have them may not necessarily be that old.
The factors must have had a lot of authority, mustn't they?
Yes. Yeah. Who were the custodians of these? That's the other, you know, from a very sociological, demographic point of view. Who kept this going? There were, of course, the Shakas. You know, the Shakas may have been. But very soon, just like the Dharmashastras, the Upanishads seem to have taken a life of its own. So you have the Brahma Sutras that are taking the Upanishads as a sort of a unit, you know, not just my Upanishad or your Upanishad, but as a, so there's this, the Supra Shaka reality comes in. Just like the Bhagavad Gita very early started life of its own, outside of the epic from which it was taken. So these Upanishads seem to have taken a life of their own outside of the Brahmanas and the Vedic text of which they were a part, you know, in their original location.
There is evidence of that even before Shankar?
The Brahma Sutras seem to, I mean, the problem with Brahma Sutras is that we don't know what it's saying. For the most part. Unless you have a commentary, you don't know what he's saying, you know. But it seems to, at least in the eyes of the commentators, seem to be commenting on various Upanishadic text, statements as a unit. And the Brahma Sutras seem to be therefore a conception of the Upanishads that are beyond the Shaka distinctions.
And there are commentators on the Brahma Sutras before Shaka.
There seem to have been, but
the
we don't.
Starts early.
Yes, and we don't have the earliest commentary is Shankara. We have the Bhaskara's commentary, but Bhaskara is probably a contemporary or a little later than. Shankara comments that. But we don't have the commentaries.
Right, we know they existed. But so we don't know how much earlier they were.
Right.
Well, sadly, this is the last of the readings of the Upanishad, as our Arivan has given. So thank you so much indeed.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
The lecture on Monday, was it?
Oh, it's indeed. It's in the one of the Orientals.
Monday, I think. Yes, I hope it's Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.